I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Congress has reportedly brokered a deal to put more cash back in the pockets of Americans, hoping a quick jolt to the economy will keep a full-blown recession at bay. Democratic and Republican lawmakers have reached a tentative agreement on an economic stimulus package that would give tax rebates of $3 to $1,200 to practically anyone who makes a paycheck. In addition, the Fed is expected to cut the interest rate again next week, especially after news today that sales of existing homes last year took the biggest plunge in 25 years. Well, joining us to pull all this news together is Peter Coy. He's economics editor at Business Week. And Peter, if this economic stimulus package is passed by Congress, how would the tax rebates work?
The tax rebates would go not only to people who actually pay taxes, but to people who earned too little money to pay taxes. And that was a key part of the compromise that the Associated Press is reporting on. What the Democrats had to give up is that there apparently will not be special increased assistance for the unemployed and for people receiving food stamps. That means it's going to be controversial on the Democratic side. What the Republican side gave up is that they did agree that they would extend these payments to people who don't have normally income tax payments.
Why were the Democrats pushing for more help for those on food stamps?
There are two reasons. One is a matter of fairness, and the other matter of economic effectiveness. The fairness argument is simply that poor people deserve more because they're in the worst financial straits. The economic argument is that if you're trying to stimulate the macroeconomy, overall economic growth, then you want to put money in the hands of the people who are most likely to spend it. And naturally, it's the people who are really living hand to mouth who will spend pretty much 100% of whatever they take in, whereas if you give money to upper-income people, they could just stash it in the bank.
Well, then can you explain, though, how rebates starting at around $300 can help pull the country out of an impending recession? Because that's what they seem to be hoping to do with this package, is give people more money to spend our way out of a recession.
Right. $300 is not much for one household, but when you multiply it across the entire country, $300 to $1,200 starts to become a meaningful sum. I think it's probably too late to stop a recession if one is kind of in train, but it could at least minimize one, make it milder and shorter than it otherwise would be.
And when would the rebate checks come?
June is the month people are talking about, which is actually pretty decent. I mean, the Congress and the Bush administration have worked very quickly together, very effectively on this. I think it's to the credit of both sides that an agreement came together this quickly, and just hope that they managed to button it up and get it into enactment.
Housing figures also came out today showing that sales of existing homes dropped 13% last year. The Fed has already cut interest rates. Another cut is expected. But David Rosenberg, an economist at Merrill Lynch, told the New York Times last week that the Fed's moves aren't likely to have an impact until late 2008. Is that too late to prevent a recession?
Fed rate cuts tend to come too late, and Fed rate increases tend to come too late. And that's no fault of the Fed. It's just that it's so hard, A, to know what's happening with the economy, and B, to get action quickly enough. It takes a long while for rates to ripple through the economy. And in fact, that goes back to what we just talked about. The income tax actions have a more immediate effect. And so the idea is to fill in the gap a little bit until the interest rate cuts that the Fed has put through start to hit late this year, early next year.
You mean so the rebate checks will be coming before any sort of feeling we might, any sort of benefit we might get from the interest rate cuts?
Right. That's the idea, sort of a 1-2 punch, and they work pretty effectively together. Whether they'll be enough to stop recession remains to be seen.
If the Fed does cut rates again next week, as expected, is that just making the problem worse, since it was interest rate cuts that played a part in at least the creation of the housing bubble?
Well, it's always a trade-off. I mean, you do worry about reinflating the problem by cutting rates too much. On the other hand, you don't want to cut off your nose to spite your face. If we have a big problem with a seriously weakening economy, then the responsible thing to do is to provide abundant credit so that businesses can keep borrowing, consumers can stay afloat. And I just think that's the reasonable thing to do at a time like this. And then once you see the economy is back on a safe footing, then you can start to withdraw that excess liquidity. But don't be too harsh right now.
Peter Coy is economics editor at Business Week, talking to us about news that Congress has agreed on an economic stimulus package. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yesterday at this time, we had a conversation about the future of the Republican Party. We spoke to David Frum, former speechwriter for President Bush, who is now critical of where the Republican Party is. Today, we turn to the Democrats. We have two guests. John Judis is visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment and senior editor at the New Republic. He's the author of several books relevant to the discussion today, including The Emerging Democratic Majority. Welcome, John.
Hi.
We're also joined by Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He's editor of the upcoming book, Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. Welcome to you, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
It looks like the economy, rather than the war in Iraq, will be the major issue in the presidential campaign going forward. John Judis, are the Democrats ready to take advantage of that?
Well, the Democrats are always better off running on the economy than on foreign policy, especially since the early 1980s when the Republican Party got the franchise as the party of national security. So even with the quagmire in Iraq, I think it's I think they're better off with the economy.
In fact, in your writing, John, you make the case that the Democrats are really poised to become the country's majority party. How so?
Well, let me be clear about that. I'm talking about Congress, and I think it's extremely likely that the Democrats will maintain their hold and even increase their hold over the House and the Senate. The presidential elections are a different species in America because presidents are both prime ministers and kings or queens, and people expect of them different kinds of things. Character is more important, what kind of politician you are, and a presidential candidate also has to span all kinds of different interests that local politicians don't necessarily have to span. The Democrats can run an anti-abortion gubernatorial candidate in Colorado and a pro-abortion candidate in Massachusetts, but the presidential candidate has to be all things to all people. So, you know, they could win the Congress and lose the presidency. It's by no means certain.
Well, how has the political makeup of the Democratic coalition changed?
Well, it's less the old New Deal party based upon blue-collar workers. It's not rooted anymore in the white working class, though the Democrats have to win 50% or more of those voters, especially in the northern states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Missouri, in order to carry those states. But it's a party of minorities and women and professionals. And I don't mean all women or all professionals or all minorities, but you know, big majorities of those three groups. And professionals in particular are kind of the vanguard of the Democratic Party. Their politics have been defining the Democrats, and I'm thinking particularly of the kind of ideas about new Democrats that started in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and Bill Clinton was very much that kind of a Democrat, and so was Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They're both they both represent a kind of fiscally moderate, socially liberal politics, and that's the politics of the liberal-minded professionals in the United States.
Well, Julian, let's turn to you for a moment. Senator John Kerry said he could win the presidency without winning the South in 2004. Do you see the Democratic Party resonating in parts of the country where Republicans have dominated?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Democrats are resonating in part as a reaction against Republicans. I mean, that's what happens when the establishment party is in trouble, that, you know, the Democrats can pick up seats, pick up votes for the presidency in areas that have been rather barren over the past, two election cycles. And at the same time, I think going back to the earlier conversation, the economy is somewhere where Democrats are just a lot more comfortable than Republicans. It's the flip and the reverse of national security. And you see in the Republican Party this struggle over how to deal with working class, middle class voters between Huckabee and Romney and McCain. And I think Democrats have a real opportunity to go in areas like the South and use this issue and capitalize on that moment.
Well, let's listen to the three leading Democratic presidential candidates. First, here's Barack Obama on the war in Iraq.
I have been opposed to this war from the beginning. And I will bring this war to an end. And I will bring our troops home in 2009.
Health care costs have doubled. Gas prices have more than doubled. Unemployment has risen. Approximately 800,000 homes in our country are in foreclosure today.
I was the first to come out with a universal health care plan, first to come out with a global warming plan, first, and to the best of my knowledge, only at this point, to come out with a comprehensive, detailed plan to end poverty in America since we are on Dr. King's Day.
That's Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and finally John Edwards. Edwards is speaking at the CNN debate on the Martin Luther King holiday. Julian Zelizer, what are the Democratic traditions that these three candidates represent?
Well, I think with Edwards, you see something of a populist tradition from the Democratic Party that goes back to William Jennings Bryan that really focuses on this battle between the wealthiest Americans and the poorest Americans. With Barack Obama, you see more of an anti-politics tradition. The theme of reform, the theme of changing the system is very much front and center. This goes back to Adlai Stevenson, to Jimmy Carter. It's another very powerful tradition in the party. And finally, I think what we see with Hillary Clinton is something of pragmatic liberalism, kind of a centrist liberal tradition that her husband certainly was part of, but really goes back further even to Franklin Roosevelt. Liberals who worked within the system and who were willing to make compromises to achieve what was possible. And I think, you know, beyond the battle between the personalities, we have this battle over the party in those three traditions.
And so Hillary Clinton, pragmatic liberalism, Barack Obama, anti-politics, John Edwards, populism. John Judas, how does that fit into your argument that the electorate is swinging Democratic?
Well, the only thing I'd say about that is that Edwards' populism is a kind of both newly acquired and not entirely of the older stripe of populism. A lot of his votes are coming from college-educated voters, and who are anti-corporate in a different sense. If he were running a real working-class campaign, I think he'd be talking more about immigration and less about some of the subjects he is talking about. So even Edwards, and when he won in North Carolina, his real base of support was the research triangle, which is professionals, minorities, and Charlotte again, which is again at that kind of community. So I think the Democrats. What I'd say is, I agree with the what seem like the rhetorical differences, but they're very similar, the three of them.
John Judas is visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment and senior editor at the New Republic, and we're also speaking to Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. We'll be coming back to that conversation in just a moment. Later in the show, the troubled history of the largest public works project in American history, Boston's Big Dig. It's Here and Now. I'm Monica Brady Meyerov. It's Here and Now. Our conversation on the Democratic Party continues with Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and John Judas, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment and a senior editor at the New Republic. Well, coming right up around the corner, South Carolina's primary is Saturday. Based on the traditions we were just talking about, Julian, what do you think a Clinton victory would mean, or an Obama win, or an Edwards win?
Well, you know, I think the Clinton appeal traditionally, when it comes from a Southerner or non-Southerner, is it can do well in parts of the country that are often Republican. I mean, that's the big promise of the Clinton campaign, not just to attract the vote of core Democratic voters, but also of these moderate and independents. And I think a South Carolina win could convey that message, that Clinton could appeal to the African-American constituency, but also appeal to, you know, middle-class professional whites who might even go Republican in another candidacy. So I think, you know, that's part of what she wants to tap into in the South Carolina race.
John, what do you think if Barack Barack Obama or John Edwards wins?
Well, I think Barack Obama is going to win because I think he's going to carry a very high percentage of the black vote. So I think the other questions really aren't that worth answering. In terms of his future, I think the problem he's going to have coming out of South Carolina is to avoid being seen as the black candidate, and Hillary as the so-called, if you want to use that, white candidate. And that's a big problem for him. That's a problem for her also if she wins the nomination. And if you go back to 1988 and the Jackson-Dukakis race, that can be a big problem for the Democrats. You can have disillusioned black voters, whatever. So I think the South Carolina primary is fraught with peril for the Democrats.
Interesting. All right, here's something I want you both to weigh in on. Yesterday, we spoke to David Frum about the Republican Party. He's the former Bush speechwriter who's calling for a very different course of action for the Republican Party today based on what sound like some Democratic principles. He talks about something like proposing universal health care, a new conservative environmentalism that promotes nuclear power over coal and oil. But he also says the Republicans have to stay true to their base. Let's listen.
My Republican Party is a party of strong American assertiveness in the world. It is the party that believes in American power, that is willing to use it, which Democrats, unfortunately, often are not. So there are real differences. And I also think that the parties need to differentiate themselves from each other so that voter choice becomes meaningful.
John Judis, what's your take on what David Frum is saying about the Republican Party?
Well, you said he was going to talk about health insurance and stuff. I didn't hear that. All I heard was the defense stuff, unless I wasn't hearing right. I think that both Romney and McCain, if they get the nomination, are going to move to the center. Both of those people come out of the more of the centrist, moderate wing of the Republican Party, but have tilted right, particularly in Romney's case, in order to get the nomination. And I think you'll see from them a much more. Government-oriented economics than you'll see now. You won't just see tax cuts. I mean, Romney will start bragging about how he brought the universal health insurance to Massachusetts, and McCain will trot out more of his anti-corporate rhetoric that he used a lot in 2000, but has laid aside this year.
Julian, we also heard yesterday that one of the commentators said the Republicans might need to have a washout in this election to get their clocks cleaned so that they can reset their agenda. What do you think? How are these parties differentiating themselves in this election?
Well, I mean, there's some truth to that. You have a party in disarray, I think, with the Republican Party, but they can still win. I mean, many people have pointed to how easy it would be for the Democrats to lose this, and we just pointed to some of the tensions in the Democratic coalition. So you could see a John McCain or maybe a Mitt Romney come out of this, be victorious, and the Republicans don't look as sick as some people think they do politically and electorally. But overall, you know, I think there's still some differences in how do you use government. I think both parties support government. I think the idea of small government conservatism is gone after the Bush years, or it's certainly weakened. And now the question is kind of where do you use government? Where do you use it overseas? What kinds of programs do you use it for within the United States? When you're dealing with health care, is that about tax accounts and incentives versus some more standardized, you know, insurance program? And so in some ways, we have a debate shaping up about how to use government and what kind of government to have, rather than a debate over the virtues of government, which was more 1980s politics.
Yeah, well, the man who started that conversation is Ronald Reagan. And what do each of you make of the role Ronald Reagan is playing in this year's campaign? Candidates on both sides are invoking his name. John?
Well, let me just say one thing about the point you were just talking about. I think if you do have a situation where Romney or McCain win the presidency, and you have a Democratic Congress and one that's more Democratic than the current one, I think that sets up a real nightmare scenario, especially with McCain, who has had very frosty relations with his own party. And, you know, you could go back to the Nixon years, the trouble Reagan had in his second term, Clinton's problem when he was a Democrat and you had a Republican Congress with investigative powers. So I think the country is going to be in for a real rocky 4 years if we have divided government in this circumstance where you have a reemerging Democratic majority, but you'll still have a Republican president.
Julian, what do you think about that? just briefly.
I agree. I mean, the only added thing is that we have a more polarized country than we did either under Nixon and Reagan, and certainly a more polarized Congress. The parties are farther apart on many key issues. So it could be even more volatile than the Nixon years, which is hard to believe.
Well, it will be interesting. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. John Judas is visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment and senior editor at the New Republic. Thanks for speaking with us.
Sure.
Thank you.
Bye.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll check in on South Carolina. Democrats go to the polls there on Saturday to register their choice for president. Also, what happens to a family when a father says he's going to become a woman? That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, some call it Boston's Big Dig, others call it the Big Boondoggle. Now the firm that managed the construction of the nation's most expensive highway project admits it got away with defective work. That story coming up here and now. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Your tax dollars help pay for Boston's Big Dig, the nation's most expensive highway project. Final price tag, nearly $15 billion. That's $12 billion over budget. But it was poorly built, with substandard concrete causing hundreds of leaks, and the wrong glue led to a ceiling collapse that killed a woman being driven through the tunnel. Well, now the company that managed it is being held accountable. Bechtel Parsons Brinckerhoff agreed to pay more than $400 million as part of a legal settlement that spares them criminal charges. As a Boston Globe editorial puts it today, quote, "It might seem as though the defendants got off easy, but in the agreement, Bechtel acknowledges it got away with defective work." Joining us on the line is Boston Globe correspondent Sean Murphy. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Monica. How are you?
Good. Tell us, what does this legal settlement say that's so damning to this global corporation?
It portrays Bechtel Parsons Brinckerhoff as negligent, as having been hired to be the ears and eyes of the state on behalf of the taxpayers, but not following through, not doing their job, not holding up their end of the bargain. Essentially, Bechtel Parsons Brinckerhoff was charged with making sure the contractors did what the specifications called for, dry tunnel, among other things. And time again, Bechtel Parsons Brinckerhoff, its engineers, essentially looked the other way.
That's what they've signed in this legal agreement. What else have they said about it? Why did they agree to this settlement?
Well, they want to move on. More than anything else, Monica, Bechtel Parsons Brinckerhoff, two top-shelf corporations of, you know, very high reputation and huge reach around the world, they want nothing more than to get out of town and to forget this whole debacle. And this presented the opportunity to do just that.
So then what happens from here then? They get out of town, but the tunnel is open. It's leaking.
Well, you and I and your listeners must use this infrastructure. We must drive through it, some of us every day or twice a day. It remains to be seen how bad it is. We know it's bad. We know there's been at least three major flaws in this tunnel system, the breach of the slurry wall, the leaks that hundreds of leaks that riddle the O'Neill Tunnel, and then this tragic, fatal ceiling collapse. We don't know what else is latent and not yet visible to us that may haunt us in the years to come.
So if more problems arise, who's responsible?
Well, you know, there's a clause in the agreement. If it's catastrophic, if there is a flaw, if, for instance, walls begin to deteriorate and that the cost is over $50 million, then the state and the feds can go after Bechtel Parsons Brinckerhoff once again. But right now, you know, some of money's been paid to allow this consortium, it's really two of the major corporations acting as a joint venture, it allows this consortium to get out of town. And we take on the risk.
Well, tell us more about Bechtel. Is this kind of settlement unusual for them, or do they build this kind of settlement into the cost of them doing business?
Well, I mean, any huge corporation, and it's my understanding they have about $20 billion of annual receipts. They have 40,000-plus jobs worldwide. A corporation that size would have to have some contingency fund. To my knowledge, I don't know of any instance where they've been tagged so badly for such an expense. And it's not, I should hasten to add, Monica, it's not merely the cost of $407 million they're promising to pay. It's the reputational hit as well.
Yeah, what will that hit be, and what else are they working on around the world, and what have they done?
Well, they've done virtually everything. Any kind of complex construction management engineering, Bechtel has done. Bechtel, San Francisco-based, built the Hoover Dam, for instance, built many, if not most, of the nuclear reactors in this country, whole cities in Saudi Arabia. They're worldwide. Sometimes Bechtel employees themselves will say in a sort of smug way, Bechtel, we built the world. It's not their official motto by any means, but there is a culture that we are the best. We're the top shelf. And once people join Bechtel, they generally stay for life. They view themselves as the creme de la creme among engineering and construction management. They take this big hit now, and they just hope everybody ever, forevermore just forgets about the big dig. And they go on. They certainly will survive. They're not every corporation is able to do what they're able to do. If the government needs a huge job and needs it done quickly, as in Iraq, then they turn to Halliburton and Bechtel and corporations such as that.
Bechtel's out of Iraq right now, I understand. And this agreement, though, doesn't bar them from bidding on future federally funded contracts. So I guess those employees can still go on saying maybe that we build the world. So Bechtel could be coming to a project near you. Why weren't they barred? And will this hurt their ability to get future projects?
Well, yes and no. I mean, more than anything else, Bechtel needed to avoid what's known as debarment. Bechtel needed to avoid being put on that list of corporations that can no longer bid for government jobs. Bechtel and Parsons Brinckerhoff and corporations like it live on government contracts. So when the Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney and the others sat around to negotiate this deal, the first thing that went on the table, I assume, from Bechtel is we cannot be debarred.
And they got it. They're not debarred.
They got it. And so if the our state authorities and federal authorities accepted that as a given opening the negotiations, then they had to have said, okay, well, then it's going to cost you dearly. Now, let's start talking some numbers. And they talked very, very high numbers. And they finally reached a place, I guess, equilibrium, they call it, where both sides could live with it. I'm sure neither side was entirely satisfied. But it's, you know, that then becomes, you know, classic deal-making. That's what happened here. It was a deal. One thing that Bechtel had going for it is what you might call virtually unlimited resources. It could continue to pour money for lawyers and accountants and consultants of all sorts to continue fighting the state. And the state would have to continue paying a like cost to keep up with Bechtel. And that would be a tremendous drain on the state's budget. So everybody decided, well, let's cut our losses. Let's not put a tremendous amount of money into further investigation. Let's find a number we can both live with. And as far as the state's concerned, I think it was a respectable number. That's a very high number.
That's right, more than $400 million to end what could be, as you say, a very long, drawn-out legal battle. Sean Murphy, thank you very much for talking with us about the big dig and the settlement with Bechtel, Parsons, Brinckerhoff.
Thank you, Monica. I appreciate it.
Sean Murphy is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. And this note about some of the stories in the works. With recession looming, we talk about the consumer debt crisis, with many Americans carrying the equivalent of 2 months' income in credit card debt. Also, ahead of the State of the Union, what would you say if the world was listening? You're listening to Here and Now. Hybrid pickup trucks, sports cars that run on alcohol, smaller, greener, sleeker. These are the trends of the future, as showcased at this year's Detroit Auto Show. Wall Street Journal editor Joseph White attended the show, and he joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, you wrote in the journal that this year's innovations aren't the kind that are necessarily obvious at first glance. What do you mean?
Well, I think the auto industry goes in cycles. They'll spend a lot of time thinking about new ways to package the car, new exterior lines and profiles. Just as a quick for instance, a few years back, Chrysler made a sensation by coming out with the PT Cruiser, which was sort of a pint-sized paddy wagon of the sort that no one had really seen anything like that ever. And this year, though, it's really more about what's under the skin. There were a lot of vehicles that were pretty traditional or pretty expected in terms of the way they look from 20 paces, but what the car companies were really interested in talking about was things like ethanol-powered Ferraris or Hummers that could run on an ethanol solution or diesel-powered BMWs. And diesel's not an unusual technology, but for the United States, it is. So we don't have a lot of diesel luxury cars in this country. And that was really, I thought, the theme. And it's all aimed at the same problem, which is the concerns about our oil consumption and about the climate.
So we're looking at a petroleum-free future at this year's Detroit Auto Show.
Well,
and a Hummer that's environmentally sound? Talk about that a little more.
Yeah,
and what are some of the other...
Like, doesn't that sound like an oxymoron? Well,
I think
what GM is trying to say there, and I believe that they have a serious business challenge that they want to address, which is that a lot of people associate the Hummer brand with planet-stomping, polar bear chomping kind of vehicle. And I think that GM recognizes that if that brand is to have a future, number one, they're going to have to offer vehicles that are smaller. And number two, they're going to have to reassure people they're not contributing to the death of the planet. They said that they want to have their Hummer fleet capable of running on E85, which is auto industry code for fuel that's 85% ethanol. I think by 2012, that's their goal, but they have the technology to do that. And that way, they'd like to hope that they can inoculate the Hummer brand from this sort of anti-green image that it has right now.
But from looking at this Hummer online, it looks smaller than the regular. Are they downsizing it?
The vehicles on the Hummer showroom floor are going to get smaller and smaller, I think, in several years. So they're trying to decouple the idea of a Hummer as a giant vehicle and replace that with an image of a Hummer as kind of a go-anywhere, rugged vehicle, but not necessarily a giant.
And I see that Land Rover is doing the same thing, and Chrysler's jumping in with remaking their Jeep, the Renegade, showing that four-wheeling can be environmentally responsible.
Yes.
These cars may be ready in a few years, but will we be able to produce the ethanol that right now seems too expensive and environmentally damaging to produce to fill the gas tanks?
Yeah, that's a very serious and very crucial problem for the auto industry right now, is that they latched onto ethanol as a way to counter the criticism that all they're doing is producing vehicles that increase our oil dependence. The problem is, as you say, that first of all, producing ethanol from corn or food grain is rapidly becoming seen as a bad idea. Number two, the technology to produce ethanol from wood chips and banana peels, and I'm not really joking about that. What they're talking about.
Banana peels in your tank.
Yeah, banana peels in your tank, just like Doc Brown in Back to the Future. But the technology to do that is just over the horizon. And the challenge is going to be for the auto industry and also the ethanol industry, and there is an ethanol industry, to prove that technology can work. Interestingly, GM announced a partnership at the Detroit show with a company called Coscata, which is trying to produce ethanol from these non-food sources, wood chips and the like.
Now, getting back to the cars, what did you see that was just truly outrageous this year?
Huh, boy, there wasn't anything that just knocked me out with its sort of outrageousness. I guess I'll have to say that the Audi had a concept called the R8 V12 TDI, which is basically a version of their extreme sort of super luxuries sports car, the R8, with a 12-cylinder diesel engine under the hood. But, the whole idea of sort of a V12 monster engine, it just seems kind of ludicrous when you consider that in most of our big cities, if you go over 75 or 80 miles an hour, you're having a really great day.
And a ticket,
yeah,
if you're unlucky.
Most people spend their lives in a crawl, and you can do that with a 130 or 40 horsepower Honda Fit just as well as a $200,000 V12 diesel.
Well, Joe, thanks very much. Joe White is senior editor at The Wall Street Journal.
Anytime. Thank you.
Coming up, a woman's view on peace and security in Afghanistan. You're listening to Here and Now. In Davos, Switzerland today at the World Economic Forum, security in Afghanistan and Pakistan was discussed. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai and Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf appeared together at a session titled The Quest for Peace and Stability. Today we're talking about peace and stability in Afghanistan with a young woman who knows both countries and who's been working for women's rights in the region for a decade. Wajma Fro was born into a traditional Afghan family, one where men rule the roost, the boys go to school, the girls do not. But Wajma would have none of that. As a 17-year-old Afghan refugee living in Pakistan, she got a job writing for the newspaper The Frontier Post. She's 27 now, and she's back home in Kabul, advocating for the rights of women for the Canadian International Development Agency, or CIDA. This month, she's been in the United States, and she joins us from Washington, where she's been meeting with lawmakers. Welcome, Wajma.
Hi.
We've heard about the conditions for women in Afghanistan while the Taliban ruled. Girls weren't allowed to go to school. Women had to wear the burqa in public. Have things improved under the American-backed government of Hamid Karzai?
Definitely. The situation has changed for the women of Afghanistan after the formal fall of the Taliban, because I still believe they rule in many parts of the country. But this change isn't very much because of any other revolution. This change is because of the change in the nature of the government. The government that is now in power in Afghanistan after the elected in 2004 government, the government together with the international communities and United States support, they have an agenda for women empowerment, and we have a constitution that really guarantees equality for women and men before law and in social affairs. So there is a change, but that change isn't so dynamic. That change isn't so obvious in a lot of rural areas. You can see good changes in the urban areas.
So overall, you've seen some improvements, but only in certain areas. Talk more about that. How is life different for women living in a city versus a rural area?
It's because of more exposure to jobs, more employment opportunities for women, or maybe employment opportunities for women when they didn't have, especially during the Taliban government. They were not able to do work in the government. Now they are able to do work in the government. With the presence of plenty of international assistance, they are able to work with the NGOs, different civil society organizations. There are the opportunities for them. And in terms of now we have emerging civil society where it advocates for women's rights and women's inclusion and security and other important issues related to the country. But this is very much in the urban settings. It's very much in the areas where it's easy to engage women in discussions, where it's easy for women to get education. But Afghanistan is a country where it has 85% of its people in the rural areas. We have provinces where you can't reach there for the 8 months, constantly in a year because of snow and also because of bad road conditions, flooding, and all these issues that are happening. And because we don't have a good government system in place that would address this issue or be responsive to these issues, therefore the situation of women in rural areas, it hasn't really changed that much, or even it hasn't even changed quite that that you can even notice it.
So even though the parliament now has 27% of women and there's a Ministry of Women's Affairs, you're saying for the reality for rural women hasn't changed much. In what ways? Can you talk a little bit more about health and education?
We have a parliament with more than 27% of women there, but it's also we need to look at that. We did have a quota. If we didn't have the quota, we wouldn't have these many women in the parliament. And then having a Ministry of Women's Affairs just by a name, but then this Ministry of Women's Affairs, they do not have any operational or executive authority within the government. And it's also very typical that one can understand one woman among 27 other ministers who really do not believe in this women empowerment agenda. It's very hard for her also to fight for it. And when we talk about that, women's lives haven't changed in the provinces, particularly my focus is on health and education. We still have the highest mortality rate in the country. In one province that I have visited personally, there is some tradition that women deliver in a barn. This used to happen 100 years before, and still it's happening now.
You mean they're giving birth in barns with animals?
In barns, yeah, in one of the provinces, in a village. So what I mean here is that traditions and other ways of treatment that were used 100 years before when there was no good governance in place, and still it's happening because there is no strong system of the government to support that. In education opportunities have decreased. constantly, especially in the southeastern part of the country, because of the insecurity in that schools are being threatened. The government is not able to provide security for the schools. And like in South, women and girls have been complaining that 4 years back we could go to school, but now we are not able to go to school.
So even though every girl is guaranteed an education, you're saying
yes,
it's too insecure for them to actually attend school?
Yeah, definitely. We have everything in place. By everything, I mean that we have constitution that guarantees equal life. We have the laws there. We have the international conventions. We have the international support there. But it's just that it's not enough because we don't have a process how to get there.
What about in the city of Kabul? The Taliban may be gone from Kabul and other parts of Afghanistan, but as you've been saying, traditions haven't changed much. How do you feel as a woman working in Kabul?
The main issue is that even in Kabul, there's a lot of insecurity. It's not only the suicide attacks that is a problem. Even on the streets of Kabul, it's not safe for women to walk on the street. I personally can't walk on the street. It's not only the rockets that we are scared of or the suicide attacks. It's the traditions. Taliban have gone, but the Taliban mentality, that mentality of oppressing women, that's part of this that life there.
So what are you saying this week to lawmakers in the U.S.? You're talking a lot about security in Afghanistan. How are you telling them they can help improve the situation for women in Afghanistan?
Yeah, for the past 2 weeks, we have been working on a number of very good recommendations from the government perspective, from the civil society of Afghanistan, and asking for international and particularly the U.S. government support. And that we are talking about ensuring women's role and women's active participation, not as symbols, but as really active participation in the decision-making in the government, particularly when it comes to security. Our understanding of security isn't only about rockets and having more soldiers on the streets or patrols. But for us, security is much more than that. It's about going to school. It's about getting education. It's about getting health facilities. It's about even being able to walk on the street with a peaceful mind. So these are our recommendations that in order to ensure that broader view of security for women or human security for women, what we are doing currently is that we are coming with those recommendations for the government of United States and international community or donors that are in United States at two levels. One, that we need financial support in order to be able to carry out those implementations. On the other hand, we also need political support. We need more pressure from the United Nations, especially on the conventions that the government of Afghanistan has signed, especially the UN Resolution 1325, where it guarantees women's participation in peace processes. So these are kind of the recommendations that we are taking to the State Department, to different like those organizations in the State Department that are vital in terms of playing any role in security of Afghanistan, to ensure women's voices are part of the security programs and not only relying on the matter of the fact that it's a country, traditional country, and it's impossible to work with women, which is not the whole picture.
Wajma, thank you very much for speaking with us about women in Afghanistan.
Thank you.